It's The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. And finally, science has caught up with what every dieter has known since their first whack at 1,000 calories a day. The journal Addiction reported on a study in Taiwan, and basically it showed this. We think we've done a virtuous thing. You know, stick to the diet, live green, fight for the good cause, and then we feel entitled to indulge. In science, this is called the licensing effect. In my kitchen, it's fudge cake at 2 a.m. In Washington, it could be behind some sticky moral situations. But for now, just stick around for good food and your calls this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, when you think about it, fish are just like vegetables. New ones turn up every season with lots of great possibilities. But the thing is that we're so used to seeing the usual suspects in the seafood case, it's easy to overlook the newbies or to be intimidated by them. Well, former chef Barton Seaver has been cooking from the sea since he was a little kid. And now he's a National Geographic explorer working to reestablish healthy oceans. Barton's written a book, For Cod and Country, Simple, Delicious, Sustainable Cooking. Barton, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. It's a real honor.
So, Barton, what does it mean to buy fish in season?
Well, most of the fish that we eat are available to us year-round. However, like vegetables, each fish has a season in which it is the most plump, flavorful, juicy, most available, cheapest. And that's something that we've largely forgotten about seafood. But it's something that is worth celebrating. Just as much as the first strawberry of spring or asparagus, so too is that first plump, rich salmon coming back up into the streams. It's worth celebrating.
So, Barton, what fish are best in the spring?
Oh, well, this is many of our favorites really become available from halibut and sable fish season in Alaska and the beginning of the legendary salmon runs on the West Coast. Blue crabs, both hard shell and soft shell over on my coast and the East Coast here. The shad runs of the Connecticut River in New England and squid really available year-round as well. But when those fish are delivered fresh as they can be in the spring, that flesh is just pristine and pure and all the flavors and the aromas. I mean, wow. And it takes so little to cook them, so easy, and it's so much fun and cheap.
So we're talking here herring and sardines, I would imagine, have the same kind of treatment, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And mackerel, another one of my favorites, especially Spanish mackerel. There's a couple of different kinds of mackerel from Boston, chub and Spanish. But Spanish has the most sort of dense flesh, and it stands up well to a nice sauté or made into a taco, something like that. I mean, it's just a wonderful, rich, flavorful fish that takes on the flavors of lime and pico de gallo well, stands up to the fatty richness of guacamole. I mean, it's just a marvelously malleable flavor and something really worth eating. And again, you know, these are some of the very best fish for us in terms of omega-3 contents, can be low in toxicity and environmental toxins such as methylmercury, and really all around good eating.
These are small fish, too. So these little fish, when you mentioned the mercury thing and the contamination thing, these mm-hmm. little fish tend to be much less likely to have problems in those areas, right?
Yeah. Biotoxins such as methylmercury or PCBs are aggregated through simply eating. And a small fish eats less than a big fish over the course of its lifetime, and it's just a simple equation as that. But also it depends on where they're caught, and the life cycle of each fish. And so there's no steady, fast rule to this, but by and large, the smaller the fish, the better. And I don't mean baby fish. Let them grow up. But the fish that are naturally smaller are usually better for us.
Let's go to the flip side of fresh, though. How about canned?
Ah, canned fish. I love thinking inside the can. Canned fish really represents not only some of the most economically viable meals, some of the best for us meals that we can find with seafood, but also, honestly, some of the most sustainable as well. And this is often a surprise to people. Certainly tuna has its battles to fight, and there are sides to that, but canned tuna can be a really wonderful, sustainable, healthy product, especially when you start talking about pole-caught albacore, skipjack tunas, the chunk light varieties that usually include those two species. These are some of the more sustainable, I mean, nearly wonderfully, perfectly sustainable options that we have, low in methyl mercury.
Uh-huh.
But then look at some of the other canned products. You've got sardines, mackerel, herring. You've got pink salmon, clams, mussels, oysters, my favorite, anchovies. I mean, these are nearly across the board some of the very best things that we should be eating. And talk about ease of Tuesday night, and you're coming home from ballet and soccer, and you've got a report due, and what? Well, pull out 2 7-ounce cans of pink salmon, drain it off. A little bit of mayonnaise, fresh dill, breadcrumbs, lemon juice, throw it in the oven under a broiler. In 10 minutes, you've got a beautiful pink salmon cake, crisp and crunchy on one side, and soft and moist all the way throughout, perfectly cooked. You got your protein portion for 4 people for, $4 or $5, and you're ready to roll with your broccoli, and there you go.
Okay, Barton, salmon is an easy sell. Sardines, these are not an easy sell. Sell me on sardines. Canned sardines.
Okay. Well, you know, funny enough, our tastes are so subjugated to generational preference. Sardines were one of the most popular fish that we had in America. And, older generations just loved them. And nothing better than a sardine, especially to me, with those lightly smoked varieties packed in olive oil, where the oil inside of the can takes on of those luscious hues and the aroma of the smoke and the slight acid of the fish. And you use that oil in the vinaigrette itself, and you mix it with maybe just a little bit of a red wine vinegar and a spritz of lemon juice to really freshen it up, and whisk it with a little bit of mustard so you have this nice emulsified dressing with all of those flavors. And you take some light spring greens with a little bit of spice to them, such as young mustard, kale, and arugula, and you mix it lightly with this vinaigrette, maybe some dried figs over the top, and just a few of these, fillets of the sardine. Talk about an easy lunchtime meal. Throw that together. And,
okay. Maybe a few thin sliced potatoes. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it's the Midwest niçoise.
Barton, thanks for being with us.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Barton Seaver is author of For Cod and Country. Now, he believes having less fish on our plates with more vegetables is going to help rebalance our oceans. And he has a model recipe for the concept. It's Pacific cod with ginger braised asparagus. And it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Last weekend at our house, there was this moment of hunger desperation, so I resurrected a favorite meatless recipe. It's tart pan-roasted chickpeas with black olives and barley. It takes maybe 20 minutes from start to finish, and you can use canned chickpeas. The whole thing is done in one big wide pan, and you do a slightly different take on the sauté. Instead of the usual onion and whatever, you cook olives and chickpeas in olive oil with a little vinegar. Now, once the vinegar boils off and the chickpeas brown a little, you have this savory, tart, nutty collection of flavors. You cook in some fresh tomatoes, mint, and barley, and you're done. Oh, well, you add a bit of fresh mint at the very end, just before you take it to the table. The recipe, tart pan-roasted chickpeas with black olives and barley, is on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, for all the laughter and lusty eating, Jane and Michael Stern are doing work for the ages. They're recording what real American food is now on their website, roadfood.com, and in their visits here. Hey, you two, good to have you back with us. So what's the latest?
Well, Lynn, many great road food restaurants are blue-collar diners, dives, and truck stops. we don't normally go to eateries that have vegetarian proclivities, where the menu boasts of the integrity of natural ingredients or fair trade coffees, but we found a place to which we gladly make an exception to those rules. It's the Sweetwater Cafe in Marquette, Michigan, where the food is nutritionally virtuous and utterly delicious.
This really is not your bailiwick, if I remember correctly.
I don't think they even have a deep fryer in this restaurant.
And, you know, on our notes, I see Michael wrote the word locavore, which I didn't even think he knew what that meant. That's sustainable.
No, it's local. If you want to eat great Lake Superior whitefish caught locally and processed by Phil's Fish Market, which is three blocks away from the Sweetwater Cafe. The Sweetwater Cafe is the place to do it. Served very simply. It's a big hunk of the juiciest, pure, sweet white fish sprinkled with lemon pepper on a bed of limp spinach leaves that are saturated with butter. I mean, this to me is heaven, even though it isn't deep fried.
You know, what's fascinating to me about the Sweetwater Cafe and just this part of Michigan, the Upper Peninsula, is it's kind of like the part of America that time forgot. I mean, when we were cruising up to Marquette and then, you know, east, west, north, and south, we realized there's very few fast food places. It wasn't that same Moebius strip of, you know, Bed Bath and Beyond and Applebee's and Home Depot. It's very, very old-fashioned looking. And there's something that kind of struck us as wonderful that the Sweetwater Cafe, which has a very modern approach to food in the fact that they're into seasonal goods and using indigenous products, is kind of in the middle of this area that is so untrendy.
Well, in one sense, though, that's a very old-fashioned approach as well. That goes back a long time.
Yeah. You could certainly go back and – or you could certainly say that it's going back to the way Americans originally ate, which was stuff locally from the local farmer, the local garden. But at the Sweetwater Cafe, it's done with – a more modern sensibility. It's a kind of place that if somebody said it's in Seattle or Portland, you would say, oh, well, of course it is. But the fact that it's kind of in the middle of nowhere in the upper mitten makes it even better.
But wait, we haven't even talked about maple paste. Can we do that momentarily? This is one of the great things to eat at this restaurant. It's sort of the texture of peanut butter, but it's made out of maple from local maple trees. And you can use it to spread across your French toast or your pancakes, or best yet, to dollop it on a bowl of hot winter grain cereal that they make at this restaurant. I mean, that to me, it's very primitive but modern. It's sort of the perfect breakfast food.
And I have to say that when the little ramekin of maple cream came out, I didn't wait for the toast to come out. I just ate it with a spoon, and it was absolutely terrific. It was my own personal pot of creme.
Sounds great, guys. Thank you.
Okay, all right, Lynn, bye-bye. Bye.
Shane and Michael Stern are the creators of RoadFood.com. Now, find information on their picks at SplendidTable.org. And while you're on the site, take a look at the newest project, our ebook, Eating In. It's a quarterly journal of menus, recipes, tips, and opinions. And you can get it all at SplendidTable.org. Coming up, we're going to be back with a never-before-heard-of tea out of China. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. When you decide to go beyond the tea bag and get into what tea's about, it's one big adventure. Even after a couple of thousand years of brewing by a chunk of the world, there are still new things to discover. The experts, like tea merchant Bill Waddington, keep going to the sources, and they keep coming back with new revelations. Well, Bill's here with his brew cups, which is always a promising sign. Bill, good to have you back.
It's great to be back, Lynn. Thanks.
So where have you been, and is there a new revelation for you?
I've been in Western China, which doesn't get many visitors, especially tea merchants, even though they've been making tea there for about 2,000 years. And one thing I discovered when I was there was that I have led you astray, Lynn, over the last couple of years. I've always told you there's five categories of tea: black, oolong, green, white, and pu'er. And pu'er is that real earthy, earthy tea. I was wrong, Lynn, and I just learned it over the last few years.
Wait a minute. It's not just that you've been leading me astray. I mean, this is what most books tell you are the categories of tea.
Absolutely, and they're wrong. There are five categories of tea: black, oolong, green, white, and not pu'er. The fifth category of tea is something called dark tea, and I just stumbled across it about 4 or 5 years ago in Western China while looking for strange teas, and boy, did I find an unusual tea.
What is dark tea?
Dark tea, the Chinese name is hei cha, it's literally dark tea, is any tea that goes through a secondary fermentation process, sometimes called a post-production process. In other words, they make a tea,
right?
Typically a basic green tea, and then they go through a secondary manufacturing process.
All right. You're going to have to walk me through this now.
Okay.
Green tea is made how?
Green tea is made through a little bit of withering, a little bit of drying, and a little bit of shaping of the leaf, and that's about it.
So there's no fermentation. It's just dried, and then it's sort of heated?
Yeah. It's fired at the end to kill any enzymes in the plant so the leaf doesn't break down.
Okay. And then what happens to make it dark tea?
Then they'll take that tea and they'll put it through a secondary fermentation process. A slight fermentation occurs in the beginning, but they'll go through a post-production fermentation process. Two interesting things happen during this secondary process. Number one, a microbe, a living organism, a microorganism, naturally comes into the tea leaves during this secondary post-production process.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes a probiotic product. And also, aging is involved, so it's done over a period of time. So you have this microorganism working on the tea leaf,
mm-hmm.
and then over a period of time, from a matter of a couple months to the matter of years sometimes, and it changes the very nature and chemistry of the leaf and the liquor itself. It's pretty astounding. And I should mention, pu'er is a subcategory of dark tea. But what I discovered in my recent journeys is the world of dark tea is much, much larger than just pu'er. There's all these other dark teas that are in China and almost all made in Western China that the West, Europe, the Americas, have never seen before. And there's two or three gigantic mountain ranges and 2,000 miles between where these teas come from and the seacoasts where Europeans and Americans have always bought their teas from. So they've made these teas forever, but they always shipped them west to Tibet, Mongolia, Eastern Russia. They've been around forever, but it's a long way to get these teas to the seacoast, so they always shipped them the other direction. And Americans and Europeans just know the teas from the coastal regions.
So are they very rare?
These were originally produced by the government 1,400 years ago, and they're an everyman tea. They wanted the common people of China to have a really nice tea. So these are not expensive teas, which I love. And they're definitely geared toward everyday consumption. But they're wonderful flavors.
This is fascinating. So I gather what you've brought here today is some examples.
Absolutely. I brought a couple of dark teas that are kind of unique, but also very representative of the category.
Okay, and so what have I got here?
The first one is a basic dark tea, and it would simply be called hei cha. And this is what you're drinking right here.
All right, so you've got a cube. It's about an inch by an inch by an inch.
Yep. It's a compressed tea. Dark teas are often compressed teas.
Okay, so it is not sold loose.
They can
It doesn't
be.
Have a lot of aroma in the cube form, but now you've given me a cup of this, and it's pale amber, very pale,
mm-hmm.
clear. Mm. It tastes very fragile. It tastes a little bit earthy, but it's very subtle.
Okay.
Really subtle. Now, you said probiotic. Is mm-hmm. there a health aspect to the tea?
Well, there is a living organism in there.
I could drink this all day.
That's what I love about it. That is a great all-day drinking tea. And you can see the first steeping of that little cube of tea, it barely broke apart the tea leaves. You can re-steep this tea literally 5, 6, 7, 8 times.
You just
re-steep the same leaves.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And, yeah, there are a couple microorganisms that are common in dark tea. If you have any biochemists in the audience, they are Eurotium cristatum and Aspergillus, both that have been thoroughly studied, and they're absolutely safe, and some people say they have health-giving properties.
Okay.
The second dark tea I wanted to give you, though, I'm going to let it steep here for just a little bit.
Okay.
I buy almost all my dark tea from one family a very small company in Hunan province of China, a man and a woman. And the woman, Mrs. Zhang, who is a world-class tea botanist, amazingly, she sent me a sample of a tea about 2 or 3 years ago, and it was a little compressed piece of tea. And what she had done was blend a couple rose petals into the tea. And when I ordered, this is what came to me. Instead of a little cube of dark tea, they had made it into
a heart. This is a compressed little heart.
And when I Skyped her back and I said, Mrs. Zhang, what is this tea? This is not what I sampled. And she goes, oh, Bill, American women will love this so much. Same tea, same tea. So it's dark tea and rose petals. And before you even taste it, I'm going to ask you just to check out the aroma. Just lift up the lid of the cupping set.
Oh, my. Now, this smells has a slight, it does have the scent of a rose petal.
My daughter and I drink this almost every morning for our morning tea for the last few years.
This is really a beautiful tea. Bill, thank you.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Tea Authority Bill Waddington has created the Tea Source Shops in Minnesota. For more information on dark teas, go to the website splendidtable.org. The dog has come to Tinseltown. Yes, in the land of the Real Housewives, Brad and Angelina and the Kardashians, the hot dog is putting on the Ritz in Los Angeles. Jessica Gelt had the story in the LA Times. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So hot dogs are coming to Los Angeles. What is this about?
Well, there's just been kind of like a hot dog renaissance in the city in the past couple of years. Prior to that, it was burgers. It was gourmet burgers, you know, with oftentimes grass-fed beef and fancy toppings, and everybody was going for them. And then we just started to notice that it was hot dogs now. And that seemed to be sort of coming a bit out of the recession, actually, and also the street food renaissance here in Los Angeles as well with food carts. So kind of makes sense. And there have been just a lot of openings of new hot dog restaurants in the city over the past, you know, especially the past year.
So what are the manifestations? Because I picture there's so much imagination in L.A., right?
Yeah.
I don't picture that this is going to be the usual, some mustard, some sauerkraut and that kind of thing. There's got to be some really great loopy stuff going on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's one of the places I wrote about in the article was a place called Doghouse. And, you know, they're doing all kinds of crazy things with chili con carne and Fritos and on Hawaiian bread and, you know, tater tots on hot dogs and eggs and bacon and just, you know, really elaborate, very elaborate creations. And then, you know, there are places that are just doing traditional, you know, New York, Chicago, and Detroit-style hot dogs, too, you know, because L.A. is this melting pot of not only cultures, but cities from across America. So you've got Cody Dog opening up, which is specializing in the strictly Detroit-style hot dog. But even the owner of Cody Dog knew that he needed to put something, he actually ended up putting an L.A. dog on his Cody Dog menu, which is an L.A. dog is a hot dog wrapped in bacon, served with jalapenos and mayonnaise and mustard. And that's sort of our quintessential, we call it a danger dog. That's the dog that we serve here in L.A. that you'll find, you know, on every street corner outside of every Dodger game.
This is and a real education. Okay, now wait. What's a Detroit dog?
So a Detroit dog is typically a beef dog. Well, although a Coney dog is 80% beef, 20% pork with a little bit of milk. And it's generally served with a beanless chili.
Right.
It's very, very creamy and a little bit of mustard and diced onions.
Uh-huh.
And so we've got that. And then we had Papaya King open here this past year, which is a chain that, from New York City that opened in 1932 in New York City that came to Hollywood for the first time. And a New York, typical New York dog will be, you know, mustard and sauerkraut. But they, Papaya King has all kinds of creations as well.
You know, I think of California and L.A., super healthy stuff. So is there a super healthy dog?
Well, you can get, there's a place called Federal Bar in North Hollywood that does something called the Vegan Wiener, and that is a meatless dog. I forget exactly what's on it, but similarly, it's, you know, a vegan hot dog. And I think a few places will offer that option. You won't find that on a street corner, of course, but yeah, absolutely.
So, and has the hot dog made the white tablecloth scene yet? I mean, the burger did.
Well, You'll find them, but right now they haven't gone five-star yet. But I think that's coming. I don't think that that's far down the road, considering the way that it's looking for us.
How about celebrity sightings?
Well, Papaya King, a good sighting was Drew Barrymore sitting on a curb eating a Papaya King dog. And then the Coney Island dog was opened by Mike Binder, the actor, comedian, producer. So, you know, a lot of his celebrity friends love to go. I believe Adam Sandler is a silent partner in that. And, you know, Todd Phillips was the director of The Hangover that came in, and he told Mike Binder when he came in, I love your food, but, you know, why can't I get this dog with sauerkraut? So Binder introduced a sauerkraut dog on his menu. So everything gets mixed up here in L.A., especially when it comes to what the hotshots want to eat, you know.
Jessica, thank you.
Of course. It's been my pleasure.
Jessica Gelt's article on the L.A. hot dog renaissance appeared in the L.A. Times. Beth Ann Patrick has attempted to lasso together a huge subject: how man's attempted to civilize himself through manners, a.k.a. rules of engagement at the table and elsewhere. With the occasional tongue-in-cheek, she's written an uncommon history of common courtesy. Beth Ann, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Lynn. It is great to be here.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about this because you've been studying courtesy, and I think most of us think we know what it means. But what did you find it means?
Well, the thing that I found about courtesy is that we have different rules about it, and we call those rules manners. But basic courtesy is really the same almost everywhere. It's about how you treat others. And almost everywhere as well, Lynn, it's about thinking about other people before you think of yourself, thinking of their comfort before you consider your own comfort. That's true in almost every, I mean, I'm not an anthropologist, I'm not a sociologist, but in everything that I researched, that's what I found. The golden rule is not something that is only Judeo-Christian. There have been versions of it all around the world for thousands of years.
You said something in the book that was very striking to me. You pointed out that so many different parts of the world have something that they traditionally say when they sit down to a meal.
That's right.
And we don't.
You know, I don't know why we simply, Lynn, do not say good appetite, because that's what the other cultures say. Of course, we all know from our beloved Julia Child here in the U.S. that the French say bon appétit. In Germany, they say Guten Appetit, and people say Gleichfalls, meaning likewise. Buen Provecho, if I'm saying that with the correct accent, is something that's often spoken in Latin American and Spanish countries. So all over the world, people will say at the beginning of a meal, you know, eat well, have a good appetite. Maybe we're a little bit shy about saying that as English speakers. You know, it could be because England and France have been in a rivalry, both formal and informal, for hundreds of years. It could be because we just found it to be a little bit old-fashioned. But it's a shame, because I think it's wonderful to say to your fellow companions and diners that, you know, you want them to eat well and heartily.
It is odd that we don't do that. But what are some of the most striking food customs that you found?
Well, there are so many. The first one I'm going to tell you about is a Burmese custom, and this has to do with saying you're welcome. And I'm really interested in this because, you know, we say you're welcome, it's simply a phrase. But in Burma, in certain parts of the country, when you send around an invitation, let's say to the celebration of a baby's birth or to a wedding, what will happen is the houses in the village that accept the invitation will then receive a delivery from the person who invited them of a pickled tea leaf salad. Now, I don't know if I'm saying this correctly. It's known as lahpet, L-A-H-P-E-T, although the spelling varies sometimes as well. And it sounds delicious. I have not tried it, but it is something that the person doing the invite sends out to say, thank you so much for accepting my invitation. It's a sort of your welcome gift. So that was one that I absolutely loved. Another one that I think is really fun is, why are bread knives are blunt? And that actually has a couple of different interpretations. It's the same time period, 17th century France. Now, some people say that that was because the king didn't want fighting with pointed objects at the table. And of course, that makes a certain amount of sense. But there is also another story about that. And that's at the same time that Cardinal Richelieu, who is quite well known in history, decided too many of the people at the court were picking their teeth with their knives. And so he decided that the blunt ends would make people look a little less savage while they were at the table. He was trying to make things a little bit more refined.
What about gifts? Because I remember something about in Japan, there were traditions.
Japan has etiquette that is really very formalized. And I use etiquette rather than manners because etiquette, which is a word from the French from the 17th century, is all about how you formalize a hierarchy, treating people in a hierarchy. So in Japan, you know, you have different rules for the kinds of gifts you would give to your boss than to the kind of gift you would give to a family member, for example. So let's say you're invited to a business dinner in Japan. An American might say, well, I'm going to go out and buy one of those funny little packs of cocktail napkins with a joke on them, and that'll be a lovely gift. Not so if you're going to a dinner party in Kyoto. You really probably are best off going to a department store where they have a section for gifts for hostesses, because in Japan, the presentation is far more important than the gift. And, you can give something very lovely, a good bottle of scotch, a set of, lovely linen dinner napkins, something like that. But the way it's wrapped and the way that the wrapping is presented is more important than whatever's inside. And one of the things that I like about this is that they also have a tradition, although the wrapping may seem very elaborate and we think, why bother? Often that elaborate wrapping is reusable. The Japanese have one kind of wrapping called furoshiki, and those are sort of oblongs of cloth. They can be really beautiful. They can be anything from a humble print to a gorgeous piece of silk. And the way that the furoshiki is tied often has messages and symbolism. You can say congratulations with one kind of knot and condolences with another and that sort of thing.
So interesting, Beth Ann. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
Beth Ann Patrick is author of An Uncommon History of Common Courtesy. Well, the weekly trivia challenge is ready to go. Now, eating competition season is coming up, so this week's question is, how do competitive eaters manage to eat all that food? We'll be back with the answer and your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or call us, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I have the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, eating competition season is coming up, so this week's question was, how do competitive eaters manage to eat all that food? Well, they do it because their stomachs are unusual. Usually, our intestines act like a wave, continuously pushing along whatever we eat. Competitive eaters' stomachs don't do that. This was on the pop-sci side of popular science. One test was done with one regular person and one eating champ. The non-pro was full after eating 7 hot dogs. The champ had to be asked to stop after eating 36 hot dogs. His stomach ballooned up, but he said he never felt full. And the experts can't figure out why.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call. But you call me, tell me, and I'll be around.
It is time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Robert is calling from Zeeland, Michigan. Robert, what's up?
Hello, Len. I'm actually in Hamilton, Michigan, with my seventh grade science students right now. And one of my students, Elizabeth, has a father who was on a business trip in Qatar. So she was able to go to Qatar for a month and study. And one of the projects that we had her do was to blog about her adventures there. And in one of her blog entries, she had written about and showed pictures of the spice market. So I left her a comment about how jealous I was, being a food enthusiast, that I'd love to get my hands on some of that product. And she emailed me back and said, what would you like? And I said, well, I'd love to try some curry because it's not something that I've used before. So she brought back a large dish of curry, and it's one of the most aromatic, intense aromas of curry I've ever smelled. In fact, it needed its own hotel room during the layover in Ireland. And not having a lot of experience with these types of spices, I was just wondering what a dish I could create to bring in for my students to share, and for Elizabeth to share a little bit more about what the spice does and what it's used for. And she picked it up at the souk in Doha, Qatar,
right,
which is an ancient market. So,
well, obviously, curry probably came in with immigrants from India,
mm-hmm,
or from Sri Lanka. And
yep,
I think if you go back to, you know, in quotes, the motherland, and
mm-hmm,
look at some Indian cookbooks. One of the ones I really love is Raghavan Iyer's 660 Curries. And
wow,
it, believe it or not, I know Raghavan. And when he took on this project, I said to him, you're out of your mind. But he's a brilliant, brilliant writer. And the recipes are wonderful. And they range from very simple to more complex. But basically, this is the way you work with a curry powder, because really what a curry is sort of a stew-like dish. And everybody mm-hmm does a different spice mix to go into it. And what is your smell like? And have you tasted it?
I have not tasted it, but it's almost got like a I want to say like a ginger aroma. It's very pungent. It mm-hmm has a little bit of a kind of a sweetness to it as well.
Ah. Okay, so probably may have a lot of cinnamon and maybe, you know, dry ginger in it. It may have a lot of chili. We don't know that, but you can taste a little on your finger to find out. But this is what you're going to probably want to do. The recipe, you can go to 660 Curries. You could go to anything by Madhur Jaffrey. She's a wonderful writer, and her recipes are generally simple but authentic and really delicious. There are a lot of good writers out there right now, but this is the thing you want to do with a curry powder. You can add any kind of protein or vegetable to what I'm about to tell you, okay? You start out with a bit of vegetable oil, okay, and a mess of onions and some fresh ginger. Start out with the onions first, though. Maybe two onions that you slice up. You're going to saute that until they start to brown, okay? And then you're going to stir in maybe an inch of fresh ginger root that you've chopped up and a couple of cloves of garlic, and you're going to saute that in with maybe a tablespoon or two of that curry powder. And you're going to do that over gentle heat. You want to do that until that curry powder is really aromatic and you can smell it, but you don't want to burn it. All right? And then to that, you will add a bit of yogurt. And you'll cook that yogurt, and use whole milk yogurt if you can. And you're, yep, going to cook maybe a cup of that. And you're going to cook that very gently until the fat begins to separate from the yogurt. It's like the yogurt is being absorbed into the saute. And it disappears into it, and only its fat is there. All right? And
that
then
sounds great.
Yeah, and then you can add a little bit more yogurt. You can add even a bit of liquid if you want. It can be broth. Usually it's even water. And then you can add something like cut up chicken. You could add eggplant. You could add potatoes, cauliflower, anything that you want to that. And
so I could go with just about anything that's fresh and sounded good.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. This is a very basic curry. Very basic curry. But
you brought me over a pound of it, so it sounds like something I could bring in, let all the students taste, and then set up some cook stations, because we have a chemistry unit coming up, and let them do some exploration.
Exactly. Now, I would get a couple of curry recipes and let them try different ones, you know?
That sounds like a lot of fun. The chemistry of food is a great way to teach kids about how matter changes with heat.
Exactly. And those spices are going to change with heat. That's the key to this. You have to saute them first. And that's what they're going to learn about. So I think this will be a great lesson for them.
I'm enjoying it, and we'll let you know how it turns out.
Please call us. Let us know, okay?
Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And you can call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Erica on the line from San Diego. Erica, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'd like to talk about hummus.
Ah, as in pureed chickpeas.
Exactly. I love it, and I love getting it out at restaurants. And I even bought it from the store, but it's so expensive, and it just seems so easy to make, but I can't get it right.
Well, what's wrong with your hummus?
Well, I like it really, really creamy, you know, really rich and creamy, not kind of gritty. And I've tried it in the food processor, and I've tried it in the blender. And the blender is better, but I haven't gotten it exactly right.
Well, let's see now. What are you putting in it? Let's start there.
Well, the chickpeas. And then tahini.
Uh-huh.
Olive oil, lemon juice, and garlic.
Well, that sounds pretty straightforward. I think it's a case of how long you're pureeing it.
Okay.
Yeah. And also, how thick is your, how thick is your hummus?
I guess I like it kind of thick.
Here's an idea. Why don't you try adding a little bit of water to the mix? It sounds kind of strange, but the reason I say add water to the hummus is that really what you're doing is an emulsion. You want to get a really creamy hummus by adding the oil to get it to emulsify or totally bind with the chickpeas. But that can't happen unless the chickpeas are light enough and creamy enough that the oil can blend with them. And the only way that happens is if you liquefy them slightly. And that's why you add a bit of water to them. That lightens them. You only need a little bit of water. You've got to do this by feel. So add a little bit of water, then just pour in a bit of oil. You don't want it super oily, because one of the mistakes that people make is they add too much oil thinking that that's what's going to make it creamy. So use water, but thin it down a bit, and that'll allow you to puree it further, and that'll make it creamier.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's the trick. There is one other trick, but I can't believe any person who makes hummus commercially is using it. The real fanatics actually peel their chickpeas. Yeah, I know. It's really picky. Chickpeas have a very thin skin on them. You know, and if you notice them even in the can, they have a skin on them. And there are people who take chickpea by chickpea and remove the skin. You do not need to do that. Add a little bit of water when you're pureeing and just let her rip. That's it. So
okay,
you're there.
Perfect. Thank you, Lynn.
You are welcome, ma'am. Enjoy.
Thanks, you too. Bye.
Bye. You can call us 800-537-5252. And by the way, when you're making hummus, you don't have to limit yourself just to the, you know, the garlic and the lemon and the tahini. You can do it with straight olive oil. You can add coriander. You can add basil. You can add chilies. Hummus may not be hummus once you get done with it, but the reality is that you can puree chickpeas and you can add any flavoring you want to them. And they become a great dip and a spread. And you can use them instead of mayo. Well, you get the idea. Anyway, reach us. You can check us out on Twitter and Facebook. And you can shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Let's see. We've got Heather calling from Reno, Nevada. Heather, what is on your mind?
What I have is a freezer full of antelope. My husband is a hunter, and I've been doing, you know, a lot of stews, and we had some of it made into Italian sausage, but I have fillets in there.
Ooh, that's luxurious stuff, isn't it?
Yes, and, you know, the stews are easy as far as giving it a little more flavor and to cook it, you know, long and slow, but what type of seasoning and how would you do these fillets?
Well, I would imagine the fillets are pretty lean, aren't they?
Yes. The antelope is all very lean.
Right, right, because most game is.
Uh-huh.
So you know what I'm thinking? How about you brine it?
Oh.
Because ideally, you don't want to kill it with a lot of heavy seasoning.
Okay.
Because you really want to taste the meat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a what is because depending on what an antelope grazes on and where it's from and how old it is, it's going to have a, you know, all the taste is going to be rather different. So what is this meat tasting like?
It's milder than venison. And actually, I find it more like beef than venison as far as the flavor goes. It's not real strong.
Right.
It's very good. I actually like it.
So
more.
You really don't want to mess with it a lot.
No.
Okay, so let's do this. How about we moisten it up, and then you can slow roast it,
okay,
which will keep it really juicy as well. How thick are the fillets?
I would say, let's see, my husband, you know, he butchers it all himself.
So right, right.
I'd say they're probably maybe an inch and a half.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, so they're not big. They're
no.
not big. Okay, so you're going to brine, you brine by thickness. Okay.
Okay.
You're
okay.
going to brine them maybe 45 minutes.
And just with the salt and water?
Okay, so you're going to do this. For every cup of water, you want a tablespoon of salt and a tablespoon of sugar.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and the sugar helps soften the impact of the salt, and it gives a nice flavor. You don't really taste super sweet, but you just get a, I can't explain it. It literally just helps that meat taste better.
Okay.
And one of the things I throw in there is about a half a teaspoon of hot chili powder. Not super duper hit you over the head hot.
Uh-huh.
But something that has a medium hot quality. So it might be Aleppo. It might be New Mexico chili powder. It might even be mild ancho. It just adds a nice sparkle.
Okay.
And if you want to, crush up 5 or 6 or 7 cloves of garlic,
okay,
and throw them in. Whatever seasoning you want, use a lot of it in a brine.
Okay.
Exaggerate it in a brine.
All right.
All right? And you want to then immerse the tenderloins, the
mm-hmm.
loins,
yes,
in that. Put them in the fridge. Give them 45 minutes.
Okay.
Okay? No more, because otherwise they pickle.
Okay.
And then what you're going to do is I would sear them in some olive oil or even, you know, if you've got duck fat or some kind
mm-hmm.
of pork fat, in a pan so that they get a bit of browning on the outside. You dry them first. And then I'd cook them really slow in a low oven or over low, low, low heat. And you want to get them to about 150.
Okay.
A temperature of about 150 internal temperature. Pull them off the heat. Then let them rest for about 10 minutes.
And how high should my oven be?
If you're going to do them in the oven, I would do them probably at about 300, no more.
Okay.
275.
Okay.
Really low and slow.
Okay.
Because you want to keep them as juicy as possible.
Yeah.
And then you want to get them to that 150 internal temperature. And then you pull them out and you let them just rest. And this is really important. 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And then I would slice them not too thick.
Okay.
And I think you're going to be really home free.
And what would you serve alongside of that?
Well, you know, there's something I love to do, and I think they might really be delicious here, because the pan juices might be salty.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an OJ reduction I love to do, and it's really easy. And all you do is take several cups of orange juice.
Okay.
Boil it down to a thick syrup in a skillet.
Mm-hmm.
You can do this ahead. And one of the things you can throw in there, again, you could throw minced hot chili in there.
Mm-hmm.
You could throw sour dried cherries in there.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Cranberries could go in there. You know, dried cranberries could go in there. Garlic could go in there. Do you see what I mean? And the idea is you boil this down until you can take a flat-bottomed wooden spatula and run it across the bottom of the pan and it leaves a trail.
All right.
And this becomes a thick, sweet, sour syrup.
Ooh.
It's a glaze. And then what you can do is either just streak that or glaze the slices on the plate with that. Or you can kind of spread it over the bottom of the plate and then put the meat and whatever else you're going to serve with it. Like, it would be wonderful to do sliced boiled sweet potatoes with this and maybe something green like grilled broccoli, crisp grilled broccoli, and have this as the bottom of the plate so that every time you bite and take a bite of anything, it has to be run through that sweet sour syrup.
So good.
Yeah, I think it would work.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
I think this will be fun, you know?
I think it will be too. Thank you.
You guys enjoy.
We will.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You know, I think that's really going to be a dynamite dish. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from comedian Stephen Wright, who said, "There's a fine line between fishing and standing on the shore looking like an idiot." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Get registered for our monthly book giveaway. Take a visit to our online store and don't miss our newest publication, a quarterly ebook called Eating In with Lynn. You're going to get a menu, recipes, opinions, cooking lessons. Yeah, it's all there, and you can find information on it at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift's our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.